It is the fair choice, the responsible choice, the Labour choice to support the 94% of our children in our state schools. That is the Britain we're building. That is the Britain that I believe in. This budget will be a budget for economic growth. It will be a budget for investment. Because today we find ourselves at the very bottom of the G7 league table for economy-wide investment as a share of our GDP. And we must change that. Conference, I believe in a better Britain. A Britain of opportunity, fairness and enterprise. I know that country has sometimes felt far off in recent years, as our growth, our productivity and family finances fall behind. But it doesn't have to be that way. The British capacity for inventiveness, enterprise, and old-fashioned hard work has not gone away. So believe me when I say, my optimism for Britain burns brighter than ever. My ambition knows no limits, because I can see the prize on offer if we make the right choices now. Stability is the crucial foundation on which all of our ambitions will be built, the essential precondition for business to invest with confidence and for families to plan for the future. The Liz Truss experiment showed us that any plan for growth without stability leads to ruin. So we will make the choices necessary to secure our public finances and fix the foundations for lasting growth. Stability paired with reform will forge the conditions for businesses to invest and for consumers to spend with confidence. Growth is the challenge and investment is the solution. Investment in new industries, new technologies and new infrastructure. Let me put what we are doing into some perspective. If the UK economy had grown at just the average rate of other OECD economies under the Tories, our economy would be £140 billion larger today. That would have provided an extra £58 billion to invest in our public services without raising a single tax rate by a single penny. Revenue to invest in our schools, our hospitals, our police and all our public services. And that's not the limit of my ambitions, because with growth we will create jobs that pay enough to raise a family on for you and your children, put real money in the pockets of working people and wealth in all of our communities that flows into vibrant high streets. That is how we'll make Britain the best place to start and grow a business, whatever background you come from, wherever you grew up. Things built to last and exported around the world and made here in Britain. This is how we'll achieve what we promised, the five missions that will comprise a decade of national renewal. That is the Britain that we are building. That is the Britain that I believe in. During the election campaign, I visited businesses all over Britain, from historic brands seizing the opportunities of the future, to innovative startups at the cutting edge, to high street businesses breathing new life into their communities. Our world-leading universities, creative industries, life sciences, tech companies and professional services. I see immense potential wherever I go. But for every success story, there is potential held back. Entrepreneurs struggling to access finance. High street businesses punished by our outdated system of business rates. Builders frustrated by a planning system which hands power to the blockers. Exporters tied up in red tape by a failed Brexit deal. Too many people out of work through chronic illness waiting for treatment, or without the skills, training and security that they need to build their potential. And a welfare state that does not always incentivise work. Brilliant young people shut out of the opportunities that they deserve, and whole industries held back without a real strategy for their future. So we must learn the lessons of the Tories' failure. We must build growth in a changed world. In this age of insecurity, growth requires stability, but not stability alone. It requires active government, and it requires the contribution of people in every part of Britain, not just a few. Where there are vested interests, outdated practices, or institutional barriers obstructing productive investment, We will confront them head on. Where active government is called for, this government will act. And conference, it is time that the Treasury moved on from just counting the costs of investment to recognising the benefits too. So we are calling time on the ideas of the past, calling time on the days when government stood back, left crucial sectors to fend for themselves and turned a blind eye to where things are made and who makes them. The era of trickle-down, trickle-out economics is over. And so I can announce... that next month, alongside our business secretary, Jonathan Reynolds, we will publish our plans for a new industrial strategy for Britain. A strategy for driving and shaping long-term growth in our manufacturing and service sectors. A strategy to unlock investment, create jobs and deliver prosperity. A strategy to help break down barriers to regional growth, speed ahead to net zero and clean power by 2030, and build prosperity on strong and secure foundations. Because when I said that this Labour Party is proudly pro-business and proudly pro-worker, I meant it. This mission... this mission for investment, for growth, for jobs, is why in a few weeks' time, this government will be hosting a major international investment summit, bringing together hundreds of business leaders to send a simple message that after years of instability and uncertainty, Britain is open for business once again. And this mission is why we will reform our pension system, overhaul business rates, give power to our regional mayors and leaders, deliver a plan to get waiting lists down and people back to work, and forge a closer relationship with our neighbours in the European Union while pursuing trade deals to open up new markets too. It's why we launched a new national wealth fund to invest in new and growing industries right across Britain. And it is why Angela Rayner and I have wasted no time in ripping out the blockages in our planning system so we can get Britain building again. You know, within 72 hours of taking office, we did more to unblock the planning system than the Conservatives did in 14 years, including an end to the senseless Tory ban on onshore wind. And conference, we won't stop there. Onshore wind to bring down your energy bills. New data centres for good jobs in the industries of the future. And housing for the decent home that every family deserves. That is the Britain we're building. That is the Britain that I believe in. If you want to start or grow a business, if you want to export overseas, if you want to build in Britain but fear local opposition and delay, if you have felt the quiet desperation of jobs, opportunity and investment slipping away, then be assured, your ambitions, your hopes, your future will not be held back any longer. I have promised this hall before that what you will see in your town, in your city, is a sight that we have not seen often enough in our country. Shovels in the ground, cranes in the sky, the sounds and the sights of the future arriving. We will make that a reality. Jobs in the automotive sector of the future in the industrial heartland of the West Midlands. Jobs in life sciences across the northwest, clean technology across South Yorkshire, a thriving gaming industry in Dundee, and jobs in carbon capture and storage on Teesside, Humberside, and right here on Merseyside too. Wealth created and wealth shared in every part of Britain. That is the prize. That is the Britain we're building. That is the Britain that I believe in. And conference, because growth must be built by the many, Its proceeds must be felt by the many too. And because of the indignity and insecurity that stems from the broken link between hard work and fair reward, we will deliver on another promise, a new deal for working people, with a ban on exploitative zero-hour contracts, an end to fire and rehire, and a minimum wage which takes into account the real cost of living, so that last we will have a genuine living wage in our country. For dignity, for security, for growth, this Labour government will make work pay. That is the Britain we're building. That is the Britain that I believe in. Within weeks of entering office, we faced another choice. We could accept the independent pay review body's recommendations and give public sector workers their first above-inflation pay rise in 14 years. Or we could allow further industrial disruption to wreak havoc on our public services. Patients having hospital appointments cancelled. Parents unable to send their children to school. Key workers, the men and the women who kept us safe during the pandemic, forced to pay the price for a crisis that they did not create. The Conservatives gave no guidance to the pay review bodies on affordability, nor did they budget for the recommendations they offered. And the Conservatives will deny that this was a choice that had to be made at all. They will claim that it was a viable strategy to let industrial action continue, to let a crisis in recruitment and retention spiral, and let public services deteriorate yet further. That was not a choice I was willing to make, and it was not a choice that was in the national interest either. So I am proud. I am proud to stand here as the first Chancellor in 14 years to have delivered a meaningful, real pay rise to millions of public sector workers. We made that choice. We made that choice not just because public sector workers needed a pay rise, but because it was the right choice for parents, patients and for the British public. The right choice for recruitment and retention, and it was the right choice for our country. If the Conservative Party, they want to fight about this, if they want to argue that we should have ignored those pay review bodies, that public sector workers should fall further behind the cost of living, that ordinary families should pay the price of industrial action, if the Conservative Party want to fight about who can be trusted to make the right choices for our public services and those who use them, then I say, bring it on. Public services that we can be proud of once again with a Labour government. That is the Britain that we're building, and that is the Britain that I believe in. Let me tell you where I'm coming from. My mum and dad were primary school teachers, and I'm really proud of that. My mum was a special needs teacher at my school, and my dad was a head teacher at a different local primary. I know how hard my mum and dad worked, how dedicated they were, the long hours they put in, my sister Ellie and me playing in our dad's office whilst he worked late. And they had to do that in the face of a Conservative government that, in its every action, showed that it didn't care much about kids in schools like theirs, ordinary comprehensive schools like the one that I went to, and the kids that I grew up with. My mum and dad lived their values, and they taught me the value of public service, of hard work, of giving something back to your community. I joined this party because of three words spoken in a conference hall in Blackpool 28 years ago. Education, education, education. I joined this party because I believe that strong public services are the backbone of any decent society. Because I believe that people should rise and fall on their own merit, not on the circumstances of their birth. and because I believe that we do not have to choose between a fair society and a strong economy. I don't want kids to succeed against all odds. I want them to succeed because they deserve it, because the odds aren't stacked against them. That's the Britain that I want to live in, just like every other parent who wants the best for their kids. So I will judge my time in office a success if I know that at the end of it, there are working class kids from ordinary backgrounds who lead richer lives, their horizons expanded and able to achieve and thrive in Britain today. That starts by taking the first steps on delivering another manifesto commitment. Our promise, led by our Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, to introduce free breakfast clubs in every primary school across England. Today I can announce that that will start in hundreds of schools for primary school to age pupils from this April ahead of the national rollout. An investment in our young people, an investment in reducing child poverty, an investment in our economy. And an investment so that in years to come, we can proudly say that we left behind a Britain where the next generation has a chance to do better than those who came before it. Conference, that is the Britain that we're building. That is the Britain that I believe in. The work of change is only just beginning, and the stakes are high. Trust is a fragile thing. We've seen the consequences when mainstream politics comes up short. It falls to us to show that politics can be a force for positive change. Not through words, but through action. Through progress towards that Britain of opportunity, fairness, and enterprise. That is our task. That is my task. It comes with a great weight of responsibility. I embrace it. It will mean hard work. I am ready for it. The British people put their trust in us, and we will repay it. And when someone asks you, does this government represent me? When they ask, whose side are they on? You can tell them. When you work hard, Labour will make sure you get your fair reward. When barriers obstruct opportunity and investment is constricted, Labour will tear down those barriers. When working people have paid the price for the Tory chaos whilst waste spirals and taxes are avoided, Labour will act. And when the national interest demands hard choices, Labour will not duck them. We will make fair choices for decent public services and the people who rely on them. For investment and opportunity in every part of Britain. For an end to the naysaying, the division, the defeatism. An end to the low investment that feeds decline. And an end to the easy answers, the empty promises and the Tory stagnation. Conference, you can tell them that we stand, that we will always stand with working people. We changed our party, now let us change our country. This is our moment, our chance to show that politics can make a difference, that Britain's best days lie ahead, that our families, our communities, our country need not look on while the future is built somewhere else, that we can and we will make our own future here. A Britain trading, competing and leading in a changed world. A Britain founded on the talent and the effort of working people. That is the Britain we're building. That is the Britain I believe in. Together, let's go and build it. Thank you.
And we believe that concludes the Chancellor's speech. As she thanks the audience for the standing ovation. Although they did go a bit early, about 10 minutes ago, with applause and a standing ovation before she'd finished. And I think they remained standing for the last bit, but seemed to go down very well. Harry Farley is looking on to us. A big hug from the Prime Minister there, Sir Keir Starmer, between him and his Chancellor. Harry, what did you make of that?
Well, I thought it was interesting, the refrain that she kept on repeating, this is the Britain we're building, this is the Britain I believe in. And every time she repeated that refrain, as you say, huge cheers and applause from the audience. And in many ways, this was, I suppose, Rachel Reeves trying to set out that vision, that more optimistic tone that I was talking about just before the speech, that we were expecting, you know, criticism from some within the party, some unions, that Labour had perhaps overdone the doom and gloom, the emphasis on the inheritance they had received. There was still quite a lot of that, quite a lot of criticising the record of the Conservatives, criticising the inheritance that Labour had been left with. There was a protester, which I think will write quite early on in the speech, a protester standing up saying, stop arming Israel, and I thought we voted for change. He was quickly and quite aggressively manhandled out of the auditorium. But I suppose it gives you an indication of the level of discontent among some Labour activists, not just over the government's, I suppose, refusal to completely end arms sales to Israel. Obviously, they did impose a partial arms embargo on some contracts. But Rachel Reeves went on to sort of, I suppose, set out her economic vision. She didn't, I think, one interesting thing that I thought, that she didn't duck that controversial issue of winter fuel. She addressed that head on. She said, I know that not everyone in this hall or in the country will agree, but she says that she was not going to duck those difficult choices. She sort of addressed that head on, went on to talk about trying to get money back from COVID contracts, went on to talk about an industrial strategy, and said she was proud to have delivered public sector pay rises. As genuinely, the moment she was delivering that sentence about delivering public sector pay rises for junior doctors, for trained workers and so on, I got a news flash came into my inbox saying that nurses have rejected the government's pay award of a 5.5% rise from the Royal College of Nursing. So she may have resolved some of those industrial disputes, but certainly not all, and an indication of battles to come perhaps with other unions.
I suppose it was quite skillfully done, the bit about the winter fuel payments, as you mentioned, because, I mean, she didn't dare to mention it by name, but sort of strongly alluded to it.
Yeah, that's right. And she hasn't been afraid to say, and she repeated many times in that speech, about the difficult choices to come. I mean, the winter fuel cuts to winter fuel allowance is a difficult choice that they have already made, and there are plenty more difficult choices to come if she's to be believed, both in the budget that we're expecting at the end of October and in the spending review, which is sort of the allocation of how much money different departments will get. She said there will be no return to austerity, but that doesn't mean that there won't be cuts to certain government departments. And you speak, I mean, I speak to Labour ministers, cabinet ministers around the conference over the last day or two, and there is a lot of nervousness about what money they will get. They are certainly being asked to find savings rather than spending proposals in their department. And there is nervousness, I suppose, about the rhetoric and the ambition that Labour set out in their missions, in their manifesto. And then at the same time, the fiscal discipline that Rachel Reeves is setting out and wanting to emphasise, you know, fixing the foundations on, I suppose, not opening the spending taps, despite what she said about no return to austerity. There is nervousness among the ministers that I speak to about how much they will actually get to deliver the ambitions that they set out in their manifesto.
Do we think there was politics at play with the timing of the nurses' announcement of the rejection of the pay offer?
It's a really good question. In all honesty, I have no idea. I was just struck that it was genuinely the very moment as I was listening, she was delivering that line about delivering public sector pay rise, and at that very moment, the news flash came into my inbox that the nurses had rejected the government's pay award. It's a very good question, to one I don't know the answer to, in all honesty. But I suppose it does reflect a wider tension, I suppose, between the Labour government, you know, the first Labour government. First time we've had a Labour conference with Labour in government for 15 years, and the unions that make up a significant part of their support. And one of, we talked earlier about winter fuel allowance, and the unions are trying to bring a vote to the conference, to the Labour conference, to overturn that cut to winter fuel allowance. And it seems likely that if that vote does go ahead at some point in the next few days, that the conference would vote to overturn that cut. We should say that would just be symbolic. It wouldn't actually force the government to do that. And there is no indication whatsoever from the Treasury that they are in any way close to changing their minds or offering some kind of mitigation. But it is deeply symbolic that at the first Labour conference where they have been in government for 15 years, there is a motion on the floor and a move from the unions to oppose one of the significant measures that the Chancellor has taken so far.
As you said, her speech was interrupted by a protester complaining about arms exports to Israel. Let's have a quick listen to that moment.
They paid the price for their incompetence, their dishonesty and their law-breaking. This is a changed Labour Party, a Labour Party that represents working people, not a party of protest.
She slightly ploughed on through and got applause for doing so.
Yeah, that's right. And from what I could make out from listening across, this protester stood up and said, "Stop arming Israel. I thought we voted for change, Rachel." And she responded by saying, "This is a changed Labour Party. A Labour Party that represents working people, not a party of protest." But I suppose looking ahead to the Prime Minister's speech tomorrow, there must be concern in his team about possible protests but over those controversial issues, but whether that be the Israel-Gaza war, whether that be the cut to winter fuel allowance and other areas. It's an indication that there is still discontent. I mean, among Labour's rank and file, we talked about sort of the mood of celebration of triumph at that election victory earlier in the summer. That is very much still here. There is very much, you know, that sense of celebration, I suppose, but tinged with a sense of frustration already, less than 3 months into a Labour government. And, you know, the question that protester asked, "I thought we voted for change, Rachel," is a question that is replicated when I speak to people, you know, whether from unions, whether from perhaps from the left of the party, who want the government to be more ambitious, spending more on things like, not doing things like the winter fuel allowance, on spending more on things like health and investment in public services. Yeah. And I think those will be the questions that will be asked ahead of right up until the budget at the end of October. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Harry Farley. We're joined by Paul Johnson, Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Well, thanks for coming on, Paul. I mean, we normally get you on to analyse sort of fiscal plans and taxing and spending and so on, but I mean, there's not a lot for you to really analyse in that speech, or is there? Did you get the hair standing on the back of your neck at any moment that you're sensing something in the ether?
No, I mean, it's for the political sort of watchers to kind of do the Kremlinology and kind of work out whether there was anything that wasn't obvious to those of us listening. But it sounded to me like a general repeat of some of the tax increases that were promised in the manifesto, a repeat of not increasing taxes that she's already promised not to increase, a statement there are some difficult decisions down the way. I thought there was an interesting reference to launching a new industrial strategy around the budget, and that might have something new and interesting in it. And she was very focused on talking about investment, and that might tell us something about perhaps how she might change her fiscal rules, perhaps how she might look at some way of getting more money into investment, because that is one of the things that she's inherited, where spending is due to fall. But on the whole, you know, I think we've sort of heard it all before, and that's actually not surprising. I mean, you know, we've got a budget in 6 weeks' time, and that's, I guess, when we will really find out what the direction of travel really is.
She doubled down on a couple of things, or confirmed, if you like, the notion of this black hole. She's absolutely, sticking fast to this idea that this 22 billion that they didn't know was there, that was kind of missing effectively, and that's the background to everything. Now, you've been pretty clear that that can't quite be the case.
Yeah, I mean, look, there was a very obvious, you know, I don't hate the term, black hole in the fiscal numbers, in the public finance numbers before the election. It's a different one to the one that Rachel Rees has talked about. So there is a problem about the next 4 or 5 years in terms of avoiding, as she calls it, austerity, avoiding cuts. That was in the numbers that she inherited implied cuts. And the Labour before the election never said anything about how they would deal with that. She's talking about a different thing, which is the in-year problems that she has faced. Now, there is some truth in what she said, and that they weren't absolutely clear, but they were there if you dug a little bit under the bonnet. Clearly, you know, she had a choice about whether to offer these public sector pay rises. I think, you know, she may feel that she didn't have much of a choice, but there was some choice there. And nothing above 2% was in the numbers. But again, before the election, she knew that nothing above 2% was in the numbers. So that wasn't new. The way in which the last government budgeted for asylum costs was very poor, shall we say. So that 6 billion wasn't in the Home Office budget. That is correct. And it should have been. But actually, this government hasn't been terribly transparent itself about why it couldn't pay for that out of the Treasury reserve. I mean, that sounds very technical, but they have really not been very transparent about why that money wasn't in the reserve.
Okay, well, we move on to the budget towards the end of next month, and look forward to speaking to you again then, Paul. It's Paul Johnson from the Institute of Fiscal Studies. It's 50 years ago today, the world's first TV tech service was launched in the UK, CFAX. And I could talk about this for hours, but we haven't got long until 1 o'clock. But William Gallagher worked on the entertainment desk at CFAX between 95 and 2002. William, thanks for coming on. Now, I know you were on the entertainment desk. I'm just looking at that budget, and I just wondered, you know, how that would have been reported back in the day. What were your constraints? It was like pre-Twitter limits on words and characters, wasn't it? Yeah. What did you have to work with?
Well, Twitter does seem so easy. But, yeah, I was listening to that speech thinking, thank goodness I'm not on the news desk now. About 70 words for a page. But then there were also limits. There was a style limit of no paragraphs longer than 4 lines, no shorter than 2. Headlines had to be 39 characters across, not 38, not 40. And if you did absolutely have to go to a second page for a story, then you had to accept that people might see the second page first. And then so it had to work on its own. So everything had to be complete and changed. And of course, it had to go out immediately. That was a huge excitement in the newsroom. It's just happened. It's on CFAX right now. Mm-hmm. And it was a thrill. But listening to that speech, I was quite glad to be out of it, actually. Yeah.
See, the headlines, the headlines I read had to be exactly 39 characters. That can't be true, can it? It's one thing having a limit on characters, but not...
No, it was true, yeah. I mean, there's a technical limit. I think the actual absolute page limit was 40, but there was various codes needed to make double height headlines and colours and things. So you had a maximum of it. You could have gone less, and I suppose it would have been okay, but the house style was to fit the maximum, and you got so used to doing headlines. I mean, you did feel pretty smug when it worked first time, but you got really used to it. So, like I say, Twitter, easy.
Yeah. And what were your biggest moments at the entertainment desk in your using your 70 words or 39 characters for a headline?
I could take the most tense. This is going to sound silly, but I was there when the National Lottery started. And so every Wednesday night, I would be on the late. I would work it. And the numbers had to go up. And if you ever got the numbers wrong, I mean, don't bother coming into work tomorrow. Can you imagine putting the wrong numbers up for somebody? And we used to get complaints occasionally that we were too fast putting the numbers up. And I never quite understood that one. But the tension of it. There are things that happen to other people I think are funnier, like Elton John from the sports desk to correct a result. And there's a footballer, you're much more of a sports guy than I am, Brian Rioch. He found out he was fired.
Bruce Rioch, yeah.
He found out he was fired by reading it on CFAX. So it was, you know, a great thing to be, well, not great for him, but I enjoyed being in the centre of all that working.
Well, it was a great way of getting briefed on the day's news quite, you know, quite quickly with all this concision. I don't know. I mean, you sort of get it now, but also you sort of don't, you know, just have everything written, what you needed to do in 70 words per page. Yes. And you spent 5 minutes waiting for it to scroll through and you had your brief. True.
Yes. I mean, the concision was the thing. I mean, it was editorially you wanted to be fair and balanced, but there was no point. Even context you had to be really careful about, because it was the facts of what's going on right now that had to be said first and foremost. And CFAX kind of blurred down into news online, and you would have the three paragraphs of CFAX would appear at the top of a news online story, and then news online would fill out the more details and things. So the two services started to complement each other, but then, of course, CFAX kind of faded away. Poor little thing. Yeah.
And have you got a favourite headline you'd like to share with us that you were responsible for?
It's because it's a 39 character one. This is the only one that I remember. It was a film industry piece. There was lots of controversy about money, and it was something like Hollywood argues over the price of India, and the film was called The Prince of India. So, yeah.
At the time, but you got it within your 39 characters, which is important.
I was 5 feet taller, but I was more tall at that one, and it fitted straight away.
All right. Listen, thank you very much indeed for coming on. Thanks. That's William Gallagher, sometime entertainment man at CFAX. It's just coming up to 1 o'clock. Must Watch is coming your way next.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The 5 Live News with Dina Campbell. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has told Labour's annual party conference in Liverpool she has a relentless focus on the financial priorities of the British people. During her speech, which was briefly interrupted by someone protesting about arms sales to Israel, she promised there would be no return to austerity. But she said the state of the public finances had forced her to make difficult decisions, such as cuts to some pensioners' winter fuel allowance.
I will not duck those decisions, not for political expediency, not for personal advantage. Faced with that £22 billion black hole that the Conservatives left this year, and with a triple lock ensuring that the state pension will rise by an estimated £1,700 over the course of this Parliament, I judged it the right decision in the circumstances that we inherited.
A non-binding conference vote on the government's plans to cut the winter fuel allowance for millions of pensioners has been delayed. It's thought the vote will now take place on Wednesday as the conference is wrapping up. The leader of the Unite Union, Sharon Graham, who's calling for the plan to be scrapped, accused the government of trying to silence the voice of pensioners and workers. While the Chancellor was speaking, members of the Royal College of Nursing announced they'd voted to reject her offer of a 5.5% pay award. It comes a week after doctors accepted a 22.5% rise. The RCN said two-thirds of nursing staff voted against the award, with 145,000 members casting a vote. Elsewhere, Lebanon's health ministry says at least 100 people have been killed and more than 300 injured in a heavy Israeli bombardment in the south of the country. The Israeli military said it had targeted hundreds of Hezbollah positions after warning civilians living nearby to leave. Israel's ambassador to the UK is Tzipi Khotovali.
It's not just that it became a ghost city, they've also been totally under massive destruction. Houses being fired day by day. People are losing any chance to go back to their homes because everything being destroyed by rockets. This is something that Israel cannot carry on with. This is something the government is committed.